that.
Do you pick up me drinking?
Yeah, but I can just edit it out.
Okay. I'll try not to drink too much. I should have got a whiskey.
Welcome, welcome, everyone. I'm state-mandated Kennedy, and this is Chaos Magic News, the only podcast claiming to be the reincarnation of Victor Newberg. Today, we have a long-awaited new addition to our interview series. Seth Salem is an occultist, a Thelemite, a speaker, and an organizer. They've been holding events with lots of different UK-based esoteric groups for a number of years now with the Visible College, who are rolling out the International Thelemic Symposium this September, where you can catch not only Seth, but also amazing folks like Alan Chapman, Mog Morgan, and Dr. Halo Quinn. Cool stuff. Seth is also currently working in the Star Club, which I think they sum up very well in the website tagline, making magicians in the UK. It would also be remiss of me not to mention to our listeners, they will probably remember Seth from when we spoke about them on the regular podcast last year, when Georgia Van Ralt recanted some serious allegations against them. So, all of that said, Seth, how are you doing, sir?
Well, first things first, do what thou wilt, should be the whole of the law.
Love is the law. Love under will.
I am a card-carrying and tattoo-carrying Thelemite, so I do need to say that. But it's really nice to be here, and thanks for offering to have this chat.
No, thanks. You're the one who offered. We were just going to assume that anyone who heard the coverage of that was mad about it based on the response we got. But, you know, honestly, I'm glad you reached out. I was really surprised, but it's cool to have you. We open every single interview with this question. Usually we direct it specifically at Chaos Magic, but you're in the in-between area here, so I'll just give you the magic version. Why should you care about magic?
Well, to misquote Star-Lord from Guardians of the Galaxy, because we're one of the idiots living in a magical world. You know, the world is magical whether we like it or not, and you don't have to care about magic, you don't have to do magic, especially if you have, you know, wealth, class, status, privilege, all the doors are already open for you, right? Low magic, as it was called, was traditionally the craft of the dispossessed or the outsider. And then you've got the disparity between like black magic, which is to get results, and white magic, which is for research and attainment. But that was made up by Arthur Edward Waite, right? He's a pretty privileged guy. And if you can afford to spend hours and a lot of money on a ritual and then take the time to write everything down, if you can write even, then you don't have to worry about making sure the crops have a good yield or the goats keep producing milk. So, as I say, I'm a Thelemite. I believe everyone incarnated for a reason with shit to do, so the primary function of magical practice should be to find and do that will, so the universe is on side, then you can go from there.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer. I'm...
Thanks.
God, I gotta find the quote now, because if I fuck it up, I'll lose my fucking Thelemicred.
Is it, magic is the art and science of choosing change to occur in conformity with will, from book four?
No, it was a... You remember the quote that Crowley has about the buying a black egg, no, the egg of a black hen without haggling?
Yeah.
Well, it was.
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Oh yeah, me either. Because it's a very, you know, it's not. It's one that comes up in my work only because I'm constantly reminding people of like that was the view of most occultists at the time. This sense of, well, if you're going to be a magician, you're going to probably need the economic freedom and the education to be able to do so. So the way a lot of these older writers were, you know, writing were to people that are fundamentally different from most of the people that are involved or interested in magic today.
That's right. I mean, it's been massively profligate, right? So anybody can pick up information on magic. I know that that's something you want to talk about. But yeah, the fact that you don't have to have all of your Solomonic tools crafted from the finest materials by somebody, like a sword from a guy in Toledo and a Chasuble from somebody in France, that's a different world, and it's not the world we live in anymore.
No, not at all. Since we're talking about it already, you've been involved at the Visible College for least like what, like 5 years, a little more, less?
It's actually a decade now.
Wow, that long.
I took some time off.
Okay. Well, that explains some things. What was the beginning of that?
Well, it was first conceived when I was organizing the occult conference in Glastonbury in 2014.
Oh, okay.
I came into running the occult conference after the 2013 event, which was effectively a couple of panels because it started to run out a little bit of steam. And the well-known and also somewhat infamous Peter Gray from Scarlet Imprint was speaking at one of the panels.
Oh, nice.
The panel kind of, like I say, it's kind of run out of steam and nobody was asking questions. So I'd known Peter for a little while. I talked to him about, you know, being in an order, not being in an order, you know, the constant kind of push and pull of that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I knew some of his opinions, so I kind of put myself in the firing line, much as I'm doing today, and said, I said to him, what's the point of being in an initiatory order? What are the benefits? And he went on a big rant, and yeah, and he came back with, what have the initiatory orders ever done for us, right? Very Monty Python.
Yeah.
So when I took on the occult conference, I wanted to show that. So the first one I ran had OTO, obviously. The IOT, it had OBOD, the Order of Bards, Obates and Druids. I'm not sure how big that is in America. It had an Alexandrian Wiccan high priest and priestess couple. And it had somebody from a Dion Fortune legacy tradition. So, you know, Servants of the Inner Light, then that went to SOL. And then Dr. Andy Cooper, who runs Helios. Really, really cool Dion Fortune-esque Egyptian mythology tradition. So all of these were books to do lectures about, you know, what their orders did, and then workshops to show practical stuff, right? And that's how I always wanted the conference to be when I ran it, primarily practice focused. Out of that, though, there were a lot of people doing really good research, but not in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it's a very different landscape. You've got some wonderful events. I've got to plug Trend States, run primarily by Kevin McLaughlin, the Occulture Conference. You know, I even went to Goldsmiths University in London last year for a symposium on 21st century magic and the occult in media.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so there are all the academic practice, and they have these, you know, big dichotomies between insider and outsider practices. Like, can you study this while doing it? Can you study it without doing it, right? And Kevin McLaughlin, Dr. Jack Hunter, they both speak to this frequently. The bracketing of like, oh, well, we understand what people are doing, but it's within their culture, or it's, you know, some sort of spiritual aspect, not practical magic.
Right, right.
That's now, but 10 years ago, you didn't really have that as much. You had, you know, Malmo University was doing degrees, masters in esoteric studies. You had Exeter University also giving a sort of like an arts side version of, you know, masters in esotericism. But there was no way kind of to showcase that to the wider community that practice magic.
Mm.
So I wanted to run the Visible College to be a, you know, informative, like, you know, come along, tell us what you're working on. Because we have all these authors, right? People write books. And when they write books, they put a lot of research into it, but there's nowhere to kind of showcase that until the book happens. So I wanted to create an event for people to give their research, to give a presentation, to have, you know, like in-depth question and answer sessions. And that was the first event that I ran separate from the occult conference. And it was sort of to balance out the practice and the theory. Right, magic in theory and practice.
Right, right.
So from there, that then became other events. I had conversations around the country with people, which I, at the time, was too busy, and I couldn't maintain those, and they kind of fell over and they didn't happen. But it planted seeds for events that would spring up in the future. I was working a day job, I couldn't follow through, but now I'm in a position where I can. So kind of coming back out from that, and I've run workshops and lectures across the UK, Ireland, and given talks and stuff in different countries so that I can, you know, try and really help educate people on the concepts of magic.
The Peter Gray conversation is a good place to go with this too, because it's one thing to talk about what the initiatory orders have done for us and have, because there's plenty of criticisms there, but there's a distinct difference between that and the sort of thing that you're doing, right? They're both obviously, I guess, rooted in the sense of trying to educate people on magic, but this is different. This is actually trying to give not just specific people practicing, but like practitioners in general, an area to sort of have conversations with each other and showcase their works, right?
Yeah.
In general, I mean, that's obviously a really positive thing, but say for, you know, well, in fact, you know, it's a very positive thing for, I would say, people like you and I, or people like Peter Gray, people that have had enough of their own practice and research to sort of benefit from the idea of other people. It's different than, say, someone that's just sort of getting into this thing and then gets to see like, oh, wow, there's this big event with all sorts of people. That might even be a little overwhelming for them, I guess. There's a whole lot of information for anyone to try to process in the occult sphere right now.
Yeah.
And it's good that we can have people that are actual practitioners and academics going at it from both angles. But is it necessary, do you think, to be a practitioner these days? Like, are teachers an underrated thing in the occult today?
Some of the importance here is the argument of signal versus noise, right? Mm-hmm. You've got all of this AI-generated bullshit. I can't remember the name, but there's this nom de plume for basically a load of AI-generated books, right? That just like go out and out and out and out, and they're Amazon print on demand or whatever. Access to information is also access to disinformation. If you are able to read anything, could be reading absolute gold or absolute crap. We say in the Western Hermetic traditions, like, discernment is the first virtue of the Tree of Life, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how do you discern if all you have access to is absolutely anything? So I kind of see the in-person events as an opportunity to bring together established practitioners, and then you can signpost, you can coordinate, and that helps with community standards. I mean, you look at someone like E.A. Keating, right? Become a living god, all that shit.
Do we have to?
Right? Well, we do, because it's out there and people are still getting suckered in, and people are still like getting in touch with these awful off-brand wannabe Order of Nine Angles people. Right?
Right.
When you go to an event, you can evaluate in person. You can see somebody give a talk. You can speak to them in the pub afterwards. Like, this is different online. It can be trial by social media, which I've had a brush with. But you can still get a good feel for the mood. You can kind of like look at the constellation of good established practitioners and who they are recommending, who they're talking to, and sort of see what might be a good place to start, even if you've never done anything before.
How has being involved in this sort of thing changed your views on both the multitude of groups that you have just there in the UK, for instance, and the various different paradigms and practices that they have? I know you had a long correspondence online with Peter Carroll a number of years ago.
Pete Carroll. Now, Nikki and Julian, running the blog of Baphomet, they called it Discussing Chaos and Thelema with Pete and Seth. We actually privately had a term for it, which was Epistles at Dawn, right? Which I thought was really catchy. I got all this correspondence at the time saying, like, wow, Pete Carroll's really ripping into you. Like, oh, you're okay. You're like in a witch war with the IoT. And we were going to the pub and having a burger together, right? We were just like chatting about this over a pint. And then we'd like formulate, you know, what we were going to say to each other. Like, yeah, I'm sorry to like dispel the mystery 10 years later, but, you know, we got on really, really well. And that came from the first conference I ran in 2014. I organized a speaker's dinner because the Wiccan couple were also running a pub nearby. And so we did like a speaker's dinner. Pete Carroll came along. I mean, it's one of those things where, and like, I'm very, very careful about like the hubris and buying into my own bullshit nowadays for fairly obvious reasons, right? But at the time, I remember I was working my day job and I checked the website for the occult conference, which had a contact page, right? Mm-hmm. And it just, I had a little notification that there was a new entry in the contact page, and I looked it up and it was Peter J. Carroll saying like, hello, I'm Peter J. Carroll. I have a new book. Perhaps I could launch it at your event. I was like, okay, it feels like I've made it, right? So he came along to the speaker's dinner and we got chatting about magic, about Thelema, chaos magic, OTO, IoT. And he had a really bad cold at the time, so we didn't get too deep into it. Also, the food was really nice and we were chatting with other people. But then about a week after conference, he emailed me and said, I really enjoyed our discussion. I wasn't up to getting into it in full. Would you like to discuss this? I'm like, yeah, great. For me, just that process of getting to meet people and have those conversations, and it's the space in between, right? It's not the lecture itself. You can learn a lot from the lecture, but as a practitioner, you're going along to kind of like have, you know, this new learning or the lectures or workshops wash over you, but also to make those connections. And those connections are so important, making those in the real world. I think that's one of the most important things you can do as a practitioner.
Oh yeah, I completely agree. Even just doing this podcast for like the last year and some change now, I was shocked at the amount of it's not so much just getting to talk to interesting people all the time, it's getting to like talk to them and then like, oh yeah, well, and now you're in my inbox and we talk about things. It's really rewarding, and it's something that, especially in the beginning, because CMN got started almost in response to what we viewed as like a dearth of just bad online occult content. Not to toot our own horns, we are the funny yuck occult podcast. I get that, but so much of it is just very dry, boring people that don't care about anything other than trying to get you to buy their online course.
Oh God, yeah.
But being able to have a space to not only present people that we think are great and think are doing very interesting things in the occult and have these kind of conversations, it's also really good to get to, you know, meet these people and have genuine relationships with them, being able to have someone to talk shop with that's not some rando on the internet when you went into the Thelema Facebook group and said, hey, what do you think this chapter of the Book of Lies means?
Yeah, I mean, and this is it, because you learn so much about your own practice by having good conversations with other practitioners. There's almost that friction between paradigms. You got to have a little bit of cut and thrust. And that's kind of what Pete and I were trying to do. That's what I've always looked to do. I'm a big fan of not just having speaker Q&A. So the symposium in September, we're going to have paired blocks of speakers on vaguely the same sort of subjects or areas, and then a joint Q&A. So not only do you get questions from the audience, but then you see the practitioners talking to each other and discussing those and debating those as well.
Oh, word. That's going to be amazing. What was the genesis of the International Thelemic Symposium then? Just because we need something other than Noticon.
So, first of all, I have to say, this is not my original brief, right? Okay, this was an event set up in the 80s by Mog Morgan, who runs Mandrake of Oxford, a publishing company.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's actually like a very long standing. Like, you can go back and find like GeoCities sites talking about the Thelemic Symposium 1996.
Wow, didn't know.
I mean, that's the event where Jake Stratton Kent and David Rankin first met.
Oh, okay, all right.
I talked to Dave Lee from the IoT back in January, and he said that, you know, they all used to get on a bus from Sheffield and they'd have like an IoT tour bus come down just to go to the symposium, right? So it's actually a big event, right?
We'll have the Visible College get involved with it.
It's very simple. Mog wanted to resurrect it. He spoke to me at the Cardiff Welsh Occult Conference last October. Would you be interested in participating, speaking, maybe helping out? And I said, yeah, sure, I would. And then January, we firmed that up and said, right, let's go for it. Let's see what we can do, and work with Mog. And we pulled together a really good list of speakers. So what I can do is I can give you a little bit more information about the speakers we're going to have. So we initially confirmed, you know, myself and Star Club running a workshop, Mog and Ditty Morgan giving their workshop on Egyptian Thelemic practice. We have Alan Chapman talking about the HDA. We have Kevin McLaughlin talking about Will. So they're going to be paired speakers. And we have Dr. Angela Pooker talking about the Abbey of Thelema, Rabelais' original sort of conception that Crowley glommed onto. And Dr. Halo Quinn talking about encountering Babylon, like the phenomenology of Babylon as somebody who's not in the OTO or anything like that. But I can also confirm that we're going to have a workshop by Jason Reed on the Tao of Thelema. We're going to have a great talk by people from the Beleskin House Foundation about how Beleskin has been used over the years. And we have Caroline Wise talking about the magical art of Steffi Grant. So it's going to be a really, really good day. We also have a book launch, but that's still under wraps for now. But yeah, there's going to be a book launch either in the evening or the night before.
Nice. I will hold my tongue on the Crowley Dreamhouse people. But other than that, no, but that sounds really fucking cool. I'm stoked for it. Anyone that's in the area at the time, guys, go jump on this. Obviously, you're a Thelemite. You've had a good bit of crossover with the Chaos Magic community. And obviously, Thelema has a lot of crossover with Chaos Magic in general. Mm-hmm. What's your experience with the crossover? Obviously, you know, you have a lot of experience with dealing with these different paradigms, but how do you feel that Thelema has been influential in Chaos Magic and vice versa through the years?
It says in Lieber Null, Pete Carroll effectively wanted to start the IoT as a reaction to Thelema and the OTO, and I think it benefits for it. You know, the whole scene benefits for it. Disagreement drives innovation. Thelema is a sort of Taoist sorceress practice, and codifying that focus on intention, which Chaos Magic does, is really, really good. And then that flows the other way. So, you know, the benefit of Thelema for Chaos Magic is if you can identify your will and direct your magical efforts towards that, then both work in harmony really well. I've been pretty privileged to be invited to IoT working groups, both past and current. In fact, last weekend, this was recorded, I was in London for a big IoT working group with some people with varying sizes of hats there. And I've always been kind of the token ceremonial magician, right? It's kind of like bring your stuffy white beardy guy to work day. We brought a ritual, myself and my partner, like on behalf of Star Club. We took it was a purple magic high priestess lunar kind of a theme, right? So we took a lunar Eucharist, which was to dispel the illusions of the ego, to meet the true self in dreams. And it was also really an opportunity to do something a little bit more wacky and fun, right? So my partner says that the OTO is the autistic order and the IoT is the ADHD order. And like, I'm
so spectrum. Glad you said that.
Well, it's true, right? It is like, structure, it routine, is. Rigor over and over. And then like, let's do whatever the fuck we want and like try and do something with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful.
Yeah, so this for her was like an opportunity to be a little bit more silly than Star Club is. And because she's been training Star Club pretty much as long as it's been around. So this is like one of those things where someone's talking about their drug trip and they're the only person that finds it interesting. But I'll tell you about the ritual if you want.
Oh, I definitely want to hear about it.
Okay, so we took this Lunar Eucharist, and what we did was we took the idea of having a mirrored lunar orb that you pour your most shallow narcissistic thoughts into, right?
Okay.
Like the surface illusion stuff. And then the priestess is ritually invoked with the Orphic hymn for the moon, so to be Selene. We used two of the hymns from 31 Hymns to the Star Goddess, which is a beautiful book. And at some point, the priestess ceremonially smashes the orb, and then you have to, you know, like consume the sacrament for it. So that all sounds like really like highfalutin. But what we did was we took a white chocolate Easter egg and we put marshmallows in, all of which was vegan, by the way. We're very considerate. And we wrapped it in tin foil. Right.
Right.
And we created a sigil from our statement of intent and a barbarous mantra from that, which is something that we do in Star Club quite a lot. That's definitely an element of chaos magic that's rooted in Star Club. And so we had this foil wrapped egg with a sigil on it that everyone passed around and whispered into it all the things they love about themselves and don't want to say to anybody, but they think it really great. So this narcissistic adoration, then we smashed it. And the idea was that I opened up the foil. And I offered it round to everybody on a silver platter. And people had to want to eat the chocolate, which was full of the illusions, but they had to ignore that and eat the marshmallows, which was the true kernel of the self inside. So we all had like great fun, like making a big show of like, I want the chocolate, but no, I will eat the marshmallow, that sort of thing.
That's so great.
Right. And then at the end of it, we banished by playing Bad Moon Rising by Creedence Clearwater Revival. You just can't. Right? Because it's a bad moon. It's the bad moon we're dispelling, right? The illusion of the self.
Oh, that is absolutely beautiful. See, that is the sort of stuff I tell people as a chaos magician. I'm like, if you don't understand ceremonial magic and you need to do some shit like that, because if you spend your entire time completely entranced with the bells and smells of Catholic mass type ritual shit. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, the Golden Dawn system, you start forgetting the actual root of what ceremonial magic is about. This is all theory we can argue, but one of the big aspects of it is being able to just throw yourself into something and be enamored with it. It doesn't have to be this big, ridiculous, like fancy thing, but it has to be incredibly symbolic and you have to be very on point and into it. You know, if anyone that was a part of that ritual that didn't make a big deal about like, oh god, I want the chocolate, but no, I can't, anyone that wasn't getting into it like that, you missed the point.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone did. It was brilliant. We had such a great time. It was so good to be invited along to that. My partner's favorite moment, I think, was when we did this, like, you know, relatively sort of like drumming, like journeying part, and at the end the guy said like, okay, and let's banish by barking, and we're all like, woof, 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 woof. And it was great, and everyone just like, and she was like, wow, this is so different, because everyone was just like, yeah, okay, we bark now we bark, woof, woof, woof. And it was great. My dog's probably gonna prick his ears up at that, but so that was good. But yeah, I've always been kind of like the token ceremony magician. I got one more example if you want it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I worked with another working group, which became a book, which was cool, because I've kind of been like a stealth character in a bunch of people's books over the years, because I just get around, right? that's kind of the problem. I was invited to this circle, and it was ego magic. It was yellow for the solstice.
Okay.
I devised a ritual, which was like, and I was definitely a lot more serious and stuffy. This is like 2013. The idea was that we were going to look at projections of the ego, because everybody has like different phases of the ego, like a different face you present at your day job, different face you present down at the pub, mm-hmm. different face you present when you're doing magic and stuff or out with your friends. The idea was to kind of take a little bit of an astral journey using the LVX formula. So the sign of Osiris slain, the sign of Isis in mourning, Apophis and Typhon the destroyer, and sign of Osiris risen. I'm using the wand as the Prometheus tube, as Crowley refers to it in Liber 5 Vel Regulae.
Yes.
So it kind of took people on a journey where they were almost like in a corridor, and there were observation windows, and you could see the different versions of yourself. And you marked either a cross for those which you wanted to get rid of, or a letter Cheth for life for the ones that you wanted to keep, right? So basically Passover.
Yeah.
Passover for parts of the soul. And then you had your magical name written on the door, so we all went around chanting. So we'd say our magical name, and then everyone else would chant it and repeat, and the next person would say their magical name to, like, sort of revive Dark Night of the Soul, kill the egos that you didn't want, have new, different versions, better versions of yourself left over.
Hmm.
Okay, so that was like a tasty little ritual. It was very highfalutin with all the signs and poses and this and the other. What I love about magic in general is that I rocked up that day, and of course you submit these in advance, and then the person running the circle organizes them into a flow. Before that, in the morning, we had somebody who created a ritual where we did automatic drawing while harmonizing, like just like vocally, like rah, 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 with a vacuum cleaner to draw out like the parts of the ego that weren't needed.
Oh, okay. All right. I see. I thought this was a very Merzbo sounding thing for a second, but I get it. Okay. I'm with you.
Yeah. So it was drawing out the bad parts of the ego. You were doing your automatic drawing, and then you burned the automatic drawing to get rid of those parts. And then we were all sealed by in a lunar fashion, which meant using a tampon to draw chaos stars on each other's foreheads in nappy rash cream. Right? Great. Isn't that great?
Oh, boy. Yeah, no, that's wonderful.
And the next one after that was that we each took a piece of Rizzler paper. You know, I don't know if you got Rizzler over this. It's, you know, cigarette rolling papers, which have the sticky side, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote our magical names in gold pen and stuck it on our foreheads. And then we had like almost like speed dating, where we took 15 minutes to tell each, like we paired up, and then you told the story of your magical name to the other person, and they did the same.
Oh, okay.
So yes, that was really cool. But if you take like the vacuum ritual and the magical name ritual and you put them together, you got like a very temporal, physical aspect of what I then had written without any knowledge in like a more of an astral, you know, Yetzirah-Briatic kind of a format. And it just worked so well together. Like, that's the point where you have to say, like, actually group ritual does do something. There is a thread, there is a non-linear time is a flat circle kind of component to this, because we've all got the same ideas and they blended together so seamlessly.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Group work is, especially nowadays, incredibly, I won't even say, it's not that it's underrated. It's just a shame that like there's so many people that either don't see the value in it, or because we're all so inherently socially isolated that we just have less and less of it. Obviously there's plenty of people that just don't know other people in real life doing magic, which, you know, no offense to anybody that's in that situation, but get good. Go start a podcast, talk, or organize an event. Do something about it. But
yeah. Come to an event.
Yeah, come to an event. There you see, you don't even have to do it. You don't even have to make one. As far as being able to draw so much from the different people that you have in there, it's, if you've never done an improvised ritual with a bunch of people, not even like an incredibly deep one, just kind of like a, like I remember last week, me and my partner gave a very brief and goofy initiation into the project we're currently doing. It's Minnesota Voodoo. It's very stupid. It's entirely just a joke, right? Because there's never been no Minnesota people doing voodoo. I don't know if that joke is wasted on the international audience, because there's like Minnesota. Like, I don't know. That's like, there's like, it's America. You go, I know New York, I know California, and I know Florida because they told me to stay away from there. And that's it. Everything else is just America. But
I mean, like, Minnesota is about as far from New Orleans as you can get without being Canadian.
Yeah. So at any rate, Yeah, but we did a very brief initiation for somebody because they were interested in it when we brought it up, and we're like, well, fuck it. And we didn't have a plan or anything because this isn't, you can't really initiate people into Minnesota Voodoo except all the people on our Patreon that we already said were initiated into Minnesota Voodoo. Yours still count, but it's not a real thing. You can't actually do it. So we had to improvise this ritual real quick. And it was, and part of it's just because I know my co-host so well. We've been doing magic together for a while, even before we did the show or anything. But it was funny to see how quickly we fell into like, well, I know the general structure of how initiation rituals should go. So I'm going to do this. You do something. And it only lasted like 5 minutes, but the guy came out of it with a kind of like, oh, wow, this actually feels like something. So I took that as a win.
Well, that's it. Like, so, I mean, I one of the things about Chaos Magic I really appreciate is the stripped down nature. You got a statement of intent, you raise energy, you direct it towards a goal, and then you let it go and you banish, right? Mm-hmm. And that can be applied to anything. And, you know, as you say, with an initiation is kind of, you take somebody, you put them outside your comfort zone, you take them through a series of procedures where they can learn something. That could be like a verbal teaching, it could be a task. And then you call upon something outside yourself, even if that's like, you know, something entirely made up, to right. then initiate them and turn them inwards. So yeah, absolutely. Anything can be done in that way.
Well, because we mentioned it a couple times and we got off track anyway. So Star Club.
Yes.
We mentioned that. We said something about it. I don't know if we told everyone exactly what it is. You want to give everyone the breakdown?
So Star Club is another thing that sprang out of me running the occult conference. It was driven by kind of an engineering mindset at first. Like, you know, I actually studied chemical engineering before I fell out of uni for various reasons, including being stabbed. That's a whole different.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, as you do. But, you know, I wanted to ask the question, if magic works, how does it work? Magic does work because I've gotten like some ridiculous results. How do we frame that? And this led to what I've described as the Star Club framework and the neurognostic model, which I'm very happy to be teaching or lecturing about in the Isle of Wight on the 23rd for the conference there.
Oh, cool.
So initially, this came about through the occult conferences. I wanted to try experimental practices, right? And what I'd do is I would kind of lure speakers and practitioners from the conference back to my temple in my house. And so like, hey, we want to do something weird with Enochian magic. We want to do something weird with shamanic stuff and just see what we could do, right? And it came from the internal structure of the Visible College, which I'd created in collaboration with someone else, these eight practices. And those eight practices are kind of the meat of the whole schema. With Chaos Magic, it's that statement of intent, empowering that intent, sending out into the universe. I wanted to create a reproducible way to do that, and that became a syncretic approach, right? So I try really hard not to be appropriative. I try not to just be slapping things together. There's an overall frame to it. For those of your listeners old enough to remember Thunderbirds, it's almost the Thunderbird 2 approach, right? You've got the big carrier that does all the work, and then you've got the thing that slots in the middle that has the specific task for that specific thing. I wanted to include a lot of different practices which I knew worked, even if I didn't have them entirely under my belt as either being initiated into it, being lineaged into it, or, you know, raised in that sort of culture. Mm-hmm. So after I'd developed the initial part of it, which is the framework. So the framework itself, it's very simple. It's an adapted LBRP opening, but without closing that. And we use all elemental pentagrams because we're looking to balance in all areas, not just the earth vanishing pentagram.
Okay.
We then move into an adapted middle pillar exercise, which is pentatonic, which changes the name for Dart because the god name for Dart isn't Yahweh Elohim, it's Ruach HaKodesh. And I'm going to cite David Rankin for that source. And that then becomes this invocation, which is, you know, I am the Holy Spirit, the Lord God of knowledge, the eternal living God, Lord of the earth. Right, so it actually flows and it becomes its own thing. We have an EIO intonation mantra, which I'm getting technical here, is designed to align the three triads on the tree of life, which we embody during the rest of daily practice, with the three dantien, and also to activate those. So, it, like, you know, humans aren't just flat structures, right? We're not two-dimensional flatlanders. The tree of life shouldn't be seen as that either. So it's making the triads into pyramids. Which connect. So you've got this kind of like isometric astral self, you know, your body of light looks like a blocky 80s video game, but it works. And then we use the Enochian Holy Table chant, which is first promoted by Lomilo de Ket, because that makes the space weird, right? So we kind of got this idea that we're moving from the analytical mind to the imaginal mind, making the space weird and getting into the subconscious at that point. And I know that you have, you know, Roger Sperry's work on the left brain and right brain stuff is debunked physiologically, but that doesn't mean that there aren't analytical and creative process in the brain that run on slightly separate tracks, even if they're all co-located and that brain's a whole organism.
Hey, you're not going to get anything wrong with me here. I'm a fan of metaphors, even if they're not actual. So
cool. Yeah, that's it. So we're just using that idea. So then what we do is we take one of the eight practices and we use that as a ritual towards our ends. Now the aims are really important. Star Club is set up as an anarcho-syndicalist approach to a larger recovery. Because what I'd understood and what I'd seen is you have two types of groups, right? You have the groups like the OTO. People take initiation and they go through the same ritual as everybody else, and they keep going through the same rituals as everybody else, and eventually they get to a place where they're writing their own rituals or doing operative magic. But most of the magic is in the teaching of the initiations.
Right.
Okay, so that's your Masonry, your Golden Dawn, your OTO. And that has a really high turnover because people don't stick it out. When I was sponsoring people to first degree, I'd always say you have to carry on to third degree because if you're going to get born, you have to die because you've got the mysteries of birth, life and death at first, second and third degree. But you still get this churn, right? So people don't complete it. People leave the order. Some people leave the order and get very upset about it because they've made a magical bond that they can't fulfill, like a, you know, like a lover that's left them.
Oh, okay.
Right, because if you have a strong link to something and you're no longer a part of it or you're no longer with it, then it causes distress on someone.
Well, yeah, no, well, I mean, anything that you get that integrated into, it becomes an aspect of your personality. Getting yanked away from that's traumatic, or yeah, having absolutely. To abandon really that is. For whatever your reasons are. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
So that was kind of like the lodge structure where there's the high turnover, all the rituals are the same. It's easy to get into, but it's also easy to leave. Then you have like the coven or Bardic Grove kind of structure where you train for a long time, you demonstrate your practical skills before you can be initiated and you can be part of the group. But again, that long training process, that can put people off, people can give up halfway, but once they're in, they're doing a lot of operative magic. Okay, and that's not dissimilar from the MMM process during the IOT.
No, it's not.
So I wanted to create an anarcho-syndicalist approach to this, right? So the idea is that people come together, they form their own magical aims for a set of workings. And those are eight rituals, and they can be done like one a day, it can be one a month. We've run Star Club in that way. But then they disperse. They set group intentions, we make a statement of intent, we make three affirmations, and that then, you know, we link into the four worlds, the four elements, you know, the neuronostic model itself. And we perform these rituals in the praxis section of the group ritual towards that aim. And we empower that statement of intent, which becomes mantra, becomes barbarous words, it becomes sigils, you know, it gets inscribed onto candles. We do all this work with those intentions. And then at the end of the eight rituals, that's done. It's finished. We kind of like, I always phrase it as we're sending a rocket up to the sky, and with the statement of intent and the affirmations, the way in which it rains back down like a firework.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully not setting things on fire, but sometimes.
You need a little bit of fire. Keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, exactly. So we empower the rituals. We empower the mantra and statement of intent, sigil, so on, with the rituals in the middle. And then we go into a mantra chanting phase. So we all chant the mantra. We raise energy. We send it off with an abracadabra. And then we close with the back end of a invoking pentagram ritual, because we're looking to retain that energy. What hasn't been sent out into the universe, we want to keep within ourselves. And that's then gone over in the daily practice, the daily practice, the daily practice. It's the foundation of the work. And nobody likes that. And I do have a regular debate with Dr. Halo about, they say it should be a regular practice, I say it should be a daily practice, but that's that sort of autism ADHD thing, isn't it? Like, no, you must do the same routine every day and then you'll be magic. But this is the thing, like, so it was never actually intended to be a teaching group, genuinely.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Star Club was meant to be a club of magicians getting together to do weird rituals towards the same goal to try it out. I was in a not great place, going to admit that. I think we're going to talk about that at some point. And I had, I think there's various types of people when their life falls apart, and I'm one of the people that writes. I get back on my daily practice, I start writing again, I do my workouts, get back on my diet, and I work really hard to try and build myself back up. Part of that was codifying Star Club, and I kind of saw that this was an opportunity to try something. I didn't know if it was going to work, right? I first tested out the model at the 2017 Glastonbury Occult Conference. We had a big group ritual to close the event where we dressed up as Horus and Isis and Osiris and Thoth. Okay. And we had like people in a hall like swaying and chanting and clapping and doing this mantra. It was really fun. So I wanted to try this again. In its more like complete form. So I literally just put a statement out on Facebook saying like, hey, I have this idea for weird group ritual experimental stuff. Does anyone want to try it in Bristol? And I am good friends with a chap called Ben Dean, who is part of the people that run the Church of Rational Satanism. And he has a book called Satanic Recovery. And I recommend that to anybody who wants to look at any addiction problems they might have, but doesn't want to do it in a Christian context, because it's, you know, the AA is not the Astrum Argentum, but Alcoholics Anonymous type stuff. That's, although there's a crossover, right? But that AA has a very Christian structure, right? You have to give yourself up to a higher power. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily how magicians work. So like Wiccans would be like, well, my higher power tells me to sort my shit out. So Ben created Satanic Recovery. It's a really good book. It helps a lot of people. And he's a really good friend of mine. And I have to plug him because he's plugged Star Club before. But he was the first person that replied to my post on Facebook and said, that's weird, because I've just had a bunch of people in Bristol asking me to teach them magic and I don't really know what to teach them. So how about? And then it became this thing, right?
Okay.
So yeah, so I was speaking to Dr. Hilary Quinn about how to synthesize this, because I had an acknowledgement that witchcraft and druidry were really effective, even though they're not my home systems. So they very kindly came on board and started to put the syllabus together with me. So we have 8 practices, and they're broadly aligned into dyads, as we call them, so pairs. So it's divination, conjuration, natural magic, classical magic, sympathetic practice, ecstatic practice, visual magic, and neurognostic sorcery. And like with all good magical systems, neurognostic sorcery is a term I've made up, so I can say that I'm the only person doing it.
Yay!
Right. But the idea of this is that we have the immanent and the transcendent. I really don't like, even though I use it earlier, low magic and high magic, right? Because it comes from that time, the time where it's the privileged versus the dispossessed, right?
Right, right.
Whereas really what we're working with is stuff from over there, wherever there is, being brought here with physical tools. So like divination is where you're getting the other side to give you some kind of information, however you want to process that. Some people it's spirit guide, some people it's holy guardian angel, some people it's collective unconscious. I don't care. It works. But you're bringing that here to work with the cards. Whereas conjuration is where you're sending your consciousness to go and speak to a spirit, which primarily resides over there. Okay, so it's almost two sides of the same coin. So we have that, you know, in our schema, our paradigm, this idea that there's a flow between what's here and what's there. And we look into that in pairs. So Halo contributed massively to the natural magic, to the sympathetic and ecstatic praxes, because those are the, you know, the kind of witchcraft and druidry practices. It is about slimming down and getting rid of some of the accoutrements that aren't necessarily required for the magic to work, but it's still having an understanding and a sympathy and being embedded within that paradigm, you could almost say. So Halo and I started this, and these were a bunch of people, some of whom had a little bit of experience of chaos magic, some people had a bit of experience of ceremonial magic, quite a few people had read Damien Eccles' work, for instance. That's really big in that scene.
Yeah, it's Damien Eccles.
Not without trying to set myself up against what Eccles has written. Like, we cover a lot of, like, most of his books within Session Zero, in the foundational bit of Star Club, because we're very much a, like, you know, we're not going to spoon feed you, like, one step at a time. We're going to give you the structure and then let you fill it, right? You get a framework and you hang stuff on the framework and you build up tools in your toolbox. Mm-hmm. So we started this and we thought, okay, well, let's see if we can teach it. And we found we had really good results. We brought people together, created the first statement of intent and the first mantra, Carvet Tos Fan, which a bunch of people have tattooed on themselves along with the Star Club logo, which is really freaky to me. Oh, like, I got it done because it's my stuff, right? Then other people are like, oh yeah, went to the same tattooist. I was like, yeah, give me this tattoo. I'm like, oh. So that's weird, right? It's really weird. Even by my standards, it's weird.
You got to enjoy that sort of stuff, though. I mean, like, we had someone graffiti the CMN logo somewhere, and we were already like, that's a little too much. We love you, though. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, like, I've got to be really careful. All right. We know this.
Yeah, I get you.
So we run this cycle, and we had a fantastic closing ritual, which we rented out a big chapel in Arnos Vale Cemetery in Bristol. It's like all this Masonic tiling, and it's got like an altar area and like a big raised dais. And Hale and I were there. We were doing like chanting, doing all the stuff, and it was just amazing. And the amount of energy, and we've had some amazing results. You know, like, I'm not going to obviously name anybody individually, but we've had health benefits, we've had money benefits, jobs, houses. We've even had people like fall in love and have kids off the back of some of the intentions they set during the cycles that we've had.
Oh, wow.
I'm really happy that I can stand up and say, yeah, this gets results. But it wasn't intended to be for teaching. It was supposed to be like me and my mates getting together and doing weird rituals. And then it became this teaching thing. We're talking about initiation a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Part of that process was that people said, like, well, all this technique is great, but where does it come from? What underpins it? So in January 2020, I wrote an initiation to effectively let people know just how crazy I was and to kind of, give some idea of what the point of Star Club is. Now, the main point of Star Club, you know, you said our tagline, making magicians in the UK, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's a kind of trick to it. We lure people in to do trendy chaos magic with results and getting goals achieved and doing like fun, silly rituals. But what we also do, and this is what I'm talking about with the neurognostic model at the Isle of Wight, is we create a process where the neurological and the mystical can be integrated. And that leads to a point of not quite apotheosis, but a level of sorcery where if you're aligning your actions with your magical will, with your intentions, with the universe itself, then you're in a place of manifestation, a permanent place of manifestation. And that's what we're really doing with Star Club. We're giving people the tools to do operative magic, but at the same time, we're bringing the way their mind works and the way the universe works into a state of integration. And that's sorcery for me. That's the point.
Word. It's interesting to see how, I think it was it Jake Stratton Kent that used the term folk thalema at one point to describe how we're all sort of got this underpinning of thalema. And it's not, even in Star Club, you can see it. You can see it in that sort of that idea of putting your magical will and your mundane self in order with the universe. You can still see it there. That's very cool. I really dig it.
Cool.
I gotta ask.
And this is the thing. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, the idea with the initiation is just to be able to give people a benchmark and to understand what they have learned through the course of their cycle to become a practitioner. We have a demonstration beforehand, so no one's gonna fail the initiation, but there has to be a pass-fail, because I've taken a lot of initiations where you just turn up, it's like the fun fair ride, right?
Yeah, you get the stamp on your hand and you're good.
Yeah, you get like wheeled from this place to that place. Somebody says something, you get wheeled from that place. You have to do something. They take the blindfold off and they go, like, aha, yes. And now you're initiated. Well, we wanted something that was a pass fail, an actual test, a challenge. The ordeal had to mean something. And if you can't fail it, then you don't really pass it, right? That's my opinion.
I agree.
So we wanted to do that. And then there is an iteration. Everything in Star Club's about cycles and going through that process multiple times gives you different benefits. There's only one ritual, but the ritual happens in different ways at the same time. The idea is you can return to facilitate future cycles and go off to approach one of the different praxis in greater depth. That idea of, the Bodhisattva or Nirvana, like you either come back to teach others or you go off to do your will. It's also like the mysteries of Jesus and John. There's that idea that do you come back to teach or do you achieve what you're here to do and then go? I wanted to bake all that in, and that's kind of what the initiation is there for, to help illustrate that. And that's it.
I like it a lot. I can't remember who the hell used the term. It might have been Gwinnon or one of those random trad types. But they always talked about that true initiation was a ontological change in the initiate, right? And I think that's a lot of what you're trying to bring about. You're trying to give not only give people the tools to do it, but really set them in line to bring about that sort of metaphysical change in their life.
Yeah, that's important to me.
As especially in an age of, because our listeners know this, we are usually very critical of anyone being like, hey, come buy my fucking course or come let me show you how to do magic. I'm a big spooky so-and-so. We're incredibly critical of that. The notable exceptions we've had that we think are pretty cool are what you're doing, because all of that sounds fantastic, and everything I'd seen about Star Club since we first started talking seems really interesting. And we had another somebody that we just had on the show, Mariana Pinzon. She's doing she does lots of like life coaching courses that are related to chaos magic and the eight circuit model. Oh, that was the other question I just had to ask real quick. Where did the eight come from? Was that a specific choice, or did it have any relation to like the Chaos Star 8 points or Leary's eight circuit model or anything? Just looks fancy.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I mean, it's not related to all of those things. It came from, threes, fours, and twos, threes, and fours are really important in Star Club. The idea of having these different dyads was important to me. There's the information dyad, the natural dyad, the operative dyad, and the sorcery dyad. That's how we're getting some real technical stuff about bullshit jargon I made up, right? But divination and conjuration are paired because it's about the flow of information. Information coming to you for the cards, or you going for information to angels, demons, the flying spaghetti monster, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The natural dyad is about you, like for natural magics, the druidry stuff, it's being out, like using the resources in the natural world and like the spirits where you are. Classical magic is probably contentious, but it's what I term as going out into the universe and finding the spirits there. So it's things like the Abremelin, things like the Headless Rite, other stuff in the PGM, Mithras.
Ah, got it.
And then the operative magic dyad is sympathetic practice. So, you know, candles, hexagrams, masks,
voodoo dolls.
Yeah, voodoo dolls. But I don't have any connection to, you know, voodoo.
I know.
But I agree. And then ecstatic is where you journey, like, you know, it's sort of shamanic type stuff. It's going elsewhere to see what's out there and experience and learn in a different place. So those are the three kind of like primary types of magic. And then there's the sorcery dyad, which is visual magic. So, you know, it's your sigils, it's your bind runes, it's the like just directly interfacing with the universe. And the neuro-gnostic sorcery, that's the culmination of it. That's that integration process where you become the universe. The universe is you. You are on good terms in an animist universe, directing your will through the collective unconscious. And when that collective unconscious isn't just the people in the same room as you, but everything in the universe, that's fucking magic.
Just because I can't resist asking one more question that goes slightly off field. We mentioned the collective conscious, you know, right then. We mentioned it briefly beforehand. How influenced by Jung are you actually? Because that's a common thing among Thelemites now, I think, because a lot of them are very Jungian.
I mean, I'm definitely Jungian rather than Freudian. It's not about your mother.
It is. It's about your holy mother, your divine unconscious mother.
But yeah. Like I've referred to Liber Novus, the red book, is the big book if it's not about your mother. I think his stuff's great. I mean, yes, I've got a lot of time for Jung. I'm also a big fan of Rupert Sheldrake, if you've heard of that guy.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Came up with morphic field theory. Like, a lot of that influences the way that I teach Star Club, my approach to the universe, to morphic field theory. I always say that the Quakers are one of the best examples of morphic field theory. Because they just sit. They just sit, right? They sit and they form this collective morphic resonance between them. And then someone's moved to speak, someone else has moved to speak, someone else has moved to speak. And that comes from that upswelling, you know, that Jungian, you know, upswelling of the collective unconscious. And I think that's really beautiful. And I think that's really funny that's in such a Christian adjacent space, should we say.
Oh, well, I mean, that's the Quakers are just one among many, many of the more interesting Christian sects. I have a big hard on for Peter Lamborn Wilson called early American antinomianism, and Quakers are very much a part of that. But they have some very fascinating ideas mystically and just religiously, and it bleeds into their social life as well. It's very fascinating stuff. But if you get me talking about Quakers and freaking early antinomianism, we'll be here for another 2 hours.
So you touched on people selling online courses. Firstly, I hate online courses, right? I really do. Star Club only has like an online option under duress. I'm much more interested in in-person teaching and learning, but we did find that we had people elsewhere in the world or just in the UK that couldn't make it to Bristol for the sessions we were teaching, who wanted to learn more about the system. So we created that. Also, it's a handy way of making sure we can get the money together to rent the hall and stuff like that. What we did was we paired out the daily practice, the individual practice that people do, because we do the group rituals and then we send them away with a different element to fit into a modular daily practice. So you'll get one practice after visual magic, one practice after your natural magic, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you can bolt them together however you want, but following the group rituals, you have to do that one. So we've done that so that the individual practice has those elements and includes how to set the intentions and stuff like that. Like I said, Star Club wasn't supposed to be a teaching order. I just like to share practice and skills. I like to help other people learn. You know, my history with Gentleman for Jupiter, God, that was like 13 years ago now. And then into the OTO, I wanted to just facilitate others, you know, understanding the initiatory lessons. So I think it's really important that people do educate themselves, but we go back to that signal versus noise. So if you find someone who's good at what they do, why wouldn't you want to ask? Mm-hmm.
I agree. One of my favorite philosophy people is a guy named Bert Dreyfuss, one of the great arguments for expertise. But again, if it's just like the Quakers, you get me talking about that, we'll be here another 5 hours. So continue.
I've learned so much from, you know, like I was saying earlier, just having conversations in the pub, meeting people at events. There were some really pivotal events for me. 2011, I went to an event called the Grimoire Gathering, which was organized by Gary Nottingham. I got chatting with Jake Stratton-Kent, Peter Gray, and Alcistus, Demek, and David Rankin. And, you know, I remember David Rankin was giving a talk about angelic grimoire stuff and mentioned the Armadale. And I was like, woo, yeah, because I'm a terrible audience member. I really am. I will cheer. I will laugh. I will clap. I will, like, you know, I think Julian Vane can just about handle me the best, because he'll lean in and he'll pick on me for something. Maybe it's an opportunity to educate yourself. And I think we do have a problem with the online teaching stuff. I really do. I think it's easy, you know, back to E.A. Keating, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to mistake the glamour for substance. That's why I can't sell Star Club online for shit, man. I really can't. I wish I could. I'd be much happier. I mean, I actually don't take any payment for teaching Star Club, because I took the Oath of the Abyss last year, and you know, that's important to me. I want to see the organization grow and thrive and flourish, but at the same time, I'm just here to help people learn some stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. It's hard to sell this sort of shit when you're not trying to just shill them nonsense, you know?
Yeah.
I sent a very nasty tweet the other day, just because I have anger issues, I guess. But it was something to the effect of, we have no desire to tell you how to do magic. We have no desire to try and sell you on our way of thinking. That's why we just put out a show and shitpost instead of trying to teach middle class people magic instead of telling them to go to therapy. And that's what so much of it is. Like, it's not, and yeah. I don't even necessarily always want to blame the people doing it, because there are plenty of people that are just teaching courses on magic online that I don't think are really getting anywhere, but I don't think they're doing it maliciously. But there are plenty of people that are literally just trying to take these disaffected nihilist living in the contemporary world. These, you know, they're typically upper professionals, because those are the type of people that have money to blow on online courses. You know, the working class people aren't doing that. So, and what are they doing? They're teaching you how to do LBRP and telling you that this is what Aleister Crowley said about true will. Just a load of crap. It's just this constant thing of trying to get these, I guess the difference for me turns into, a lot of people turn to magic out of a sense of feeling hopeless in the world, feeling like there's meaningless. A lot of people go to it because contemporary religion doesn't do it for them. There's a lot of people that are using it as escapism, especially chaos magic. Chaos magic is really bad about people that have just set up doing weird magic stuff instead of dealing with their actual problems.
Yeah, there's this weird like inverse bell curve of quality appreciation. Oh, what's the guy's name? He did books called Purple Cow and Meatball Sunday.
Oh shit! Yeah, who's that guy?
You know, I'm gonna have to Google that pretty quickly, because it's gonna annoy me otherwise. Seth Godin. That was
Yeah.
There's a book by Seth Godin called Purple Cow, and he does other stuff like that about this inverse bell curve, right? If you're selling something dirt cheap, people are gonna think it's either a good buy, or it doesn't matter if they've paid for it and it doesn't work, right?
Right.
And then at the top end, if you're charging like $5,000 for a course, then like you must know what you're doing. But in the middle, everyone thinks, well, it's too expensive for me if I really need it. And if you can afford the £5,000, why would you take the £300 course?
Yeah. I get you.
It's this constant problem because all I want to do is cover costs. I don't want to fleece people. And you're right. It's the disaffected middle ground that will pay that. Mm-hmm. You've got to recognize, like you say, when people are just having a bad time, people are just having mental health problems, and try not to make anybody worse.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily how all of the online courses out there operate.
You said something earlier about this too, when we were discussing the type of people that were doing magic, right? There's this weird issue where you notice that the people that could benefit most from magic are the people that probably have the biggest barriers of entry to it, right?
Yeah.
Because incredibly wealthy people don't need magic.
Yeah.
I always make this argument when people bring up the like kind of satanic conspiracy angles and stuff. I'm like, why do the Rothschilds need to sacrifice people? You realize that if they wanted to kill people, they could probably get away with it. They don't need a magical like power to do it. Yeah,
just it.
John Rockefeller broke the record for most heart transplants. These people are literally the masters of the material world, my friend. They don't need spooky spells. We need spooky spells and conjurations to get stuff like this to happen because we are not masters of the material world. We've had all of this stuff stripped away from us for the most part.
You've got like Joseph Smith, who was using Jupiter talismans and tablets. And he made great out of that. You know, he got a church and as many wives as he wanted. But yeah, like when you're at like the top end of that, I think there's an argument that a lot of really successful people are intrinsic Thelemites. You know, like Jake would have said, because they are doing their will. They just don't know that's how that we would frame it.
Oh right, yeah. Right?
If you're doing the thing that you're really fucking good at, then you're doing your will. And if you're being successful about it, the universe has said like, yeah, great. Good on you.
Yeah, you're doing the thing. You're not getting bothered by anything.
Yeah.
Crowley said at a glance, Thelema is 90% self-discipline. And that's been more true of anything in my life. People that I really see embodying what I consider like Thelemic virtues tend to be people that are all about this sort of sense of like, I'm going to do everything I can in my power to do what I'm actually here to do.
Yeah.
And they're not always Thelemites, but they always have that kind of attitude.
Yeah, it's the whole Wim Hof. His stuff's great. I love his stuff. And that is very Thelemic. He's just not writing it that way because he's a Scandinavian guy that likes jumping in frozen lakes. But he's doing his will, man. Like he does more on that than most of Thelemites ever.
Just dragging along into it, so we might as well say this. So how does one even go about talking about this sort of situation? Anyone that's made it to this point already knows what we're talking about, but you're a member of the OTO at the same time as a certain other prominent member. Mm-hmm. You had some very serious allegations thrown at you, and that was what, 2018? Georgia Van Raalt claimed you raped her, and later went on and added Peter Gray in certain aspects to that list, blamed various other people within the OTO. Yeah, and that's an absolutely insane thing to think about. I remember I was first getting really into the online occult world at the time. That was my when I really started like getting into groups and noticing people and seeing the kind of people they're talking. And it all happened. It just blew up right then. And it was one of those things where like everyone at the time was just willing to blame not only the entirety of the OTO, but like Thelema in general for it, saying that these people are the problem. But, you know, fast forward to, you know, what, September last year, wasn't
it? Yeah, August, September.
She recants everything. And in a letter and I have to mention this in the episode, we make mention of a handful of things that were written. Some of them were gone. So the way it's standing now is, Loki's Gazette, who covered all of it, is gone. You can still find that on archive if you guys want to go look at it. So, you know, the two things that Marco Visconti wrote that were not up at the time are back. And the original letter is now gone. It's funny to feel like we're one of the few people still like acknowledging this even happened. That's kind of a gross feeling that something this big can happen. And it's just, but I mean, maybe that's indicative of just the kind of world we live in where we're so used to hearing outrageous stories, being mad as shit for about a month max, and then going about our business. Because in my mind, this is still an incredibly ridiculous story. And I mean, we said some not positive things about you.
There's the idea that Steph Salem was a shitty person. did things and treated people in a way that isn't really fucking kosher. Again, this isn't to come to the defense of poor Seth Salem, because if some of the less rapey things that have been said about him are true, he's still probably not an angel. He's probably not a guy that I'd like to sit down and have a conversation with.
These are the prominent people of the occult in a lot of ways. These are popular names. You know, the only person in there that is someone that I wouldn't, like, call a bullshit artist, con man, and a hack was, like, Peter Gray. And I'm not even, like, the biggest Peter Gray fan. He's just the only one that I don't think is, like, human garbage. That is a horrendous thing for anyone to have to deal with. Just, Do you want to talk about it? You want to tell us how you, because as far as I've seen, I didn't see you make any sort of official statement afterwards or anything. You kind of.
So I did, actually. I started up a new blog specifically to respond.
I didn't even see it. I'm a terrible newsman.
Yeah, I know you didn't.
Oh, God.
That's okay. That's all right. Yeah, I wrote quite a long response to it. I mean, first things first, I'd like to say hello to all your listeners who skip straight ahead to the drama. Hi, I'm
no, Seth. You all go listen back to the rest of this talk right now. I'm serious.
I suppose, like, wait, it's not the kind of podcast where you do trigger warnings and stuff, but, you know, like, I kind of need one. I've never actually read what she wrote about me at the time. Ooh. For my mental health. I just made a decision that I never was going to. But the way you've just introduced it, I think it's really interesting that you said Georgia recanted the whole thing, right? She said none of it was true. But that's not the case. We love in popular narrative heroes and villains, right? Mm-hmm. There's a good guy, there's a bad guy, you know, someone's in the right, someone's in the wrong, someone's the villain. But that's not the thing. The narrative now has gone as far in the other direction as it was when I was a pariah and a sex monster. So I need to be really clear about that. The narrative is now that Dr. Georgia Van Roel, she has a PhD, is absolutely valid because that was started while we were together and nothing to do with any of this. That she made a false rape accusation to get ahead in the occult world, and that's not true.
Okay.
The fact, you know, I did not rape her. She has said that I did not rape her. Legally and all the rest of it, interpersonally, that didn't happen. But I did hurt her. This is all about a night which was probably the worst behavior for both of us for a multitude of reasons. If you have your very worst day put on the record and put out in front of the entire bloody internet, it's gonna be horrific, right? I think all of us have skeletons in the closet. All of us have made mistakes, and nobody wants that being the subject of the public discourse. What really happened, and I'll boil it down, is that I hurt her, right? I was in a bad place. I was making poor decisions. And when we ended what was effectively an affair, she was really hurt. She was really hurt, and I didn't help things. And I have since gone through the process for an autistic spectrum diagnosis. And that kind of clarifies how I did what I did to hurt her and some of the things that I'd said, but that doesn't excuse it in any way. And she was angry, and she wanted to give a voice to that anger. She was with Marco Visconti at the time. That was actually on my recommendation because I thought he was a really good friend. He was not, as it turns out. Marco handed her the rape word. He went and stayed with her, and for 3 days they argued, and he said, he raped you, you know? And she said, no, he didn't. That's not what happened. That's not how it was. It was messy. Because life is messy. Relationships are messy, especially when you've got two people who are not acting in the best behavior, who are not in the best place mentally and whatever else. You know, it's a messy thing. It wasn't that, but it wasn't great. So she was convinced after 3 days, Marco telling her that I raped her, he made her make a complaint to the OTO. That didn't go anywhere because it didn't have any legs. Then it came out, this public statement that he'd made her double down on, and it was terrible. But it's still not me being a mighty hero of justice. I fucked up, right? I fucked up. I fucked up with Georgia. I was not kind to her. She was hurt. She used a word she shouldn't have used when wanting to speak to the experiences she'd had with me. And she has experience, not from me, but she has experienced genuine sexual assault, which can't be discounted just because she made a false allegation against me about rape. And it has been, and that's been horrific to see.
Yeah.
This idea that, you know, like crying wolf, like, oh, well, nothing bad ever happened to you because you made this statement that was false this one time. And this idea that she has only found fame and infamy in the occult because of that, also not true. Like, I know her work. I know her work on Babylon, on Dion Fortune. It's really good. I was reading it at the time before this all kicked off. I've seen the presentation she gave last year. Her stuff is really good, man. Now, yeah, there was a level of infamy. There was this kind of like online jihad. And she definitely made mistakes. I mean, going for Peter Gray, that was not a good idea. That was a terrible idea. And I can't speak to, you know, Peter's experience of that and what he has to say about it. That's absolutely for him to speak about, not me.
Right.
But what happened between me and her, that really should have been a private matter, you know? Like, I wanted to move on. She wanted to move on. Some people were dragging it up. Every time I poked my head over the parapet, when I first started Star Club, when I, you know, people heard that I was teaching again or I was going to conferences even, Marco would come out and say, like, oh, a known sexual predator is teaching people in the Bristol scene or he's going to conferences. Like, that was horrific.
I can't imagine.
Absolutely awful. If we're going to talk about it, we need to treat it with sensitivity and care. These are two people with other characters getting into the mix. There's this whole thing that we're in spiritual practices, right? We're here to get better. What happened to redemption? What happened to forgiveness? I suffered it for 6 years being a pariah. I had a few friends who genuinely saw my side of it, even though my actions weren't the best, but they still believed in me and they wanted to see, you know, me improve. And I wasn't my best self. And I've worked really hard on that. You know, I've done the things, I've done therapy, divorce, moving out, trying to work behind the scenes to help out various situations in the occult world over the last few years. I've worked on that. And now Georgia's in this place where she fucked up 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And in trying to do the right thing, not only has that brought that back up for both of us, but it's also like trashed her reputation and career. And nobody's focusing on the fact that she's trying to set the record straight. So all I can do is try and set it straight again in that she doesn't deserve the dog pile that she's had now.
Okay. All right. And I don't want to have to say this sort of stuff, but it's literally the things that people are going to say in response to this. It's like, obviously you've done a lot of work on the situation. Having been involved with it, you didn't have the luxury of not doing it, I suppose. But
yeah,
it's very kind of you to come out in, if not with open arms and forgiveness, or at least support and some level of empathy to what's going on there. But she's still someone that did damage not only to herself and the people involved directly, but anyone that's ever suffered any sort of sexual assault in the occult now has to deal with this as an issue. And maybe it's not fair to have to put that onus on her, but this was one of the biggest stories of that time. And you know, it wasn't something that people forgot about.
No.
Well, I mean, in direct contradiction to what I just said about people just forgetting about it after a month. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, this is something that now anyone that's been faced in this situation is now going to have to deal with. And even if we can say that she didn't do it in a sense of trying to get ahead, obviously it brought some level of notoriety to her work. And obviously it's a big thing that to make claims like that, even if you're even if the person that got trashed most about it wants to be able to defend it, it's a lot to even ask people. I mean, I'm sure there are many people that have been victims of this sort of thing that are just furious that somebody would use it.
Yeah.
And even with the pretense or the suspicion that it was to bring notoriety to their name. We talked about this on the episode. It'd be one thing if it was one person, but it kind of looks to a lot of people that it was not only her, but it was also Marco using this to bring something to themselves.
I have spent 5 years of my life getting re-traumatized every time Marco opened his big mouth on a podcast, every time he posted something on Twitter railing against me indirectly. Or directly. Getting sent screenshots of things that he said on Discord or on Twitter, like from concerned friends in the magical scene who are like, oh, hey, man, you should know what. Like, I genuinely had like trauma responses to this. I'd have panic attacks. I remember my birthday, what was it, 2022? He made this big deal. And it's re-traumatizing for me. And it was re-traumatizing for her as well. What you've got to kind of remember is that what she wanted to give a voice to about power dynamics in magical spiritual structures, that was valid. Okay, that there are things to say about that. There are ways in which I fucked up, and there are ways in which other people fuck up, and that started the whole Me Too and the OTO movement.
Mm-hmm.
If you imagine that you have started something like that and you're receiving correspondence of support and thanks from people that it's allowed them to give a voice to their experiences as well, it then becomes really difficult to unwind that, to take it back, to say, no, actually, that's not how it happened. And that, combined with the pressure from people like Marco, who wanted to keep, I think he used it to champion himself as this social justice warrior, this guy who was like fighting corners. Like, I'm not going to speak to his character directly, but I'm not a fan of it. And I think there's potentially an element of projection there, and certainly an element of jealousy from what I know directly from what I was told by people at the time and what he was saying about me. So if you can imagine that also being applied to her, to Georgia, that then feeds into this state of being unable to correct the narrative without things falling apart. It was a massive, massive problem that we're in this situation where she was the patron saint of wronged women in the OTO. Not necessarily one that by the end of it she wanted. Okay, I don't know exactly what happened. I don't know exactly what happened at the time, but I've known through back channels for a little while that there was a possibility that she would want to retract at some point, or to fix it, or to get the narrative back on track. And in trying to do so, we were speaking before her statement was made. We both worked through a lot of stuff. We had conversations which were really difficult. I came to understand a lot more about her position, and she came to understand what happened to me. I was devastated for her, because part of the reason I'm keeping my mouth shut was because the only way I could have defended myself was by dragging her down with me. I didn't want that. I wanted her to have the opportunity to go on and do amazing things. And she did. But now the narrative hasn't been corrected. It's swung the other way. And I can't speak to, Peter's experience. I can't speak to the experience of people who feel like they've been misled. I can't speak to the experience of people who have had traumatic experiences and feel they won't be believed now. That's not my place. I can't do that. And I genuinely feel for those people, because I was there. It happened to me. At the same time, I'm really close to this. Okay. Nobody's closer to this than me. I've managed to find some forgiveness. I've managed to find understanding for how it came about. And people who have never met her seem far too invested in making her the villain, when that's not how real life works, man. Can I throw in a quote?
Anytime.
All right. So in the Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn said, "The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. This line shifts. Inside us, it oscillates with the years, and even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained." You can't just paint people as black and white, and you can't paint situations like that as black and white. And that's what's been happening. And everybody, you smell blood in the water and you go in, right? Everybody wants to burn the witch. I was the witch. Now Georgia's the witch. Maybe we should just put the fucking pitchforks and torches down.
It's hard to argue with a man quoting Solzhenitsyn at you. Sorry. I had to lighten the mood a little bit, just because it's heavy shit. Yeah. It's heavy shit.
I mean, it is. And I really just wish that people would treat it sensitively. But, if I'm going to be out on the scene, people are going to ask me about it. I had several very difficult conversations when I went to the occult conference in Glastonbury in February, which was kind of the first time I'd been back there officially. And I am now helping to organize it. I'm supporting Dr. Liz Williams, who runs the conference, who took it back on from me after all this stuff. And I'm really proud to be back on that committee and helping. But yeah, people wanted to talk to me. They booked an information store on the market for the Visible College and Star Club, so that people would have the opportunity to come and talk to me somewhere quiet and say the things, because I knew there were going to be a lot of conversations that people wanted. It was tough, right? It was really tough. But at the same time, it's necessary to move past it. And I'm hoping that people can move past it, both so that I can carry on organizing events and giving people a place to meet people, and also that Georgia can eventually carry on doing the really important work she was doing. Everyone's going to hate me for saying this, isn't they?
No, I think if anything, people might reflect on the things they've done. I know I certainly am. We probably didn't do the best job of covering this, but that's not shocking to me. We don't do the best job of covering anything. We are a goofy, fun time podcast, but I'd like to think that we were at least fair enough in the situation. And while tensions were rising high, and maybe, it's very hard for me not to have to sit here and say, well, maybe you were a little too rough on everyone involved after the man involved with it is telling me so. So,
well, I mean, like, look, hey, you called all of us human garbage. I'm pretty sure I object to the human more than the garbage. So,
Hey-o.
Hey, But no, honestly, you were even-handed in the way that you reported it and you reported the facts. And it just, it was one of those stupid things. I took the Oath of the Abyss last year after a 49-day Babylon working, because I was kind of in this Jack Parsons place of like, well, should I do the Antichrist working? Should I do the Babylon working? I was like, let's try the Babylon working. I'm not quite ready to blow up in a chemical lab just yet. And the end of the 49 days, I had so much stuff happened. I was like, right, I'm going to take the Oath of the Abyss, because I was in a place in my life where a friend said, you might not have taken the Oath of the Abyss, but the Oath of the Abyss appears to have taken you. I was like, right, okay, let's do it. And then throughout that process, every 49 days, something weird would happen, like really weird. So I now call that my Abyssiversary. And and yeah, in beginning of January, I was driving all around the country asking Dave Lee to speak at the occult conference next year in Glastonbury, which he will be, you should be there. Asking, about various things with the Lemic Symposium, organising speakers, going to see a friend up in Leeds, and somebody just posted a link to your podcast episode. So I listened to it while I was driving. It was fun times. It was crunchy, but, you know, it's important to understand the discourse. If I'm going to be part of it, then I need to know what's going on. And you guys were really even-handed. You reported on the facts as best you could. You hadn't read my response, but that's just how it goes. And even without that, you weren't actually that far off the mark. So I thought I'd reach out.
We're incredibly humbled that you would actually speak to us, Seth. Honestly, I can't thank you enough. It means a lot that you would hear us talking about it and decide that you would want to engage with us in any kind of way.
Thanks.
Trust me. I mean, honestly, it really means a lot. Even with your notoriety, you are a much bigger figure than we are here at CMN.
I don't know.
The only thing we've done, the only thing that has people knowing us is we reported a rumor of the North American IoT, and a lot of people didn't appreciate it.
Well, you know, I think I said to you, like, if I've not been kicked out of something by the summer, then I'm doing it wrong. So.
I guess to take just a slight step back from it as we release the tension here, we obviously mentioned that the problems that Georgia brought to light aren't necessarily things that don't need to be talked about. But the other issue is, do you think that the occult has a problem of the other side of that, people backstabbing and fighting with each other? Do you think there's not enough actual discourse and attempting to understand each other?
I think that's definitely the case. I mean, some of the benefit of the time in wilderness is that I could take a step away from that and watch it in real time when it wasn't happening to me anymore. And it is like kind of like Reverend Neumuller's, like, you know, first they came for the Thelemites, then they came for the Chaos Magicians, and then they came for the Druids, and then when they came for the Wiccans, there was no one left to defend me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The end of the day, right, if you claim to have magical powers, you are either bullshitting or you are genuinely frightening, and there's going to be a high rate of jealousy either way.
Fair.
If one person claims they can do things, they either can or they can't, but another person is gonna be jealous of that. This is one of the things we were talking about online classes earlier. There's a grift. Some people have to make a living for it. And there are some people who do really good courses that I'm fully behind. Jason Miller, Sarah Mastros, Gordon White. Too many people to name that I think are really cool and I've done some work with here and there. But yeah, it can become that like £3,000 hedgehog Reiki bullshit course. Like I say, if I could sell bullshit, I'd be rich, right? We had, back when I first started running the occult conference in 2014, we had accusations of trying to like businessify it. Like, you know, the OTO would come in as second-rate Scientology and all the men in suits were there taking your ticket number. But there needs to be a bit of a structure to put on a good event. And that's kind of not the thing. But, you know, there's always going to be out groups and in groups, right? Like, by virtue of being magicians, we're always in an out group anyway.
Right.
So how do you feel like you're the in group? You create another out group. You know, it's the Monty Python, like, oh, where's the popular front of Judea? Like, people's front, he's over there. Splitter! this is why my focus has always been on collaborative in-person events. Because I guarantee you, people would not have said the shit they said about me to my face. Right? Because I've seen some of those people and they have not said it to my face, both during and since the retraction.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we've got to try and live. You know, we've got to try and live in the real world. If we want to affect material change in the real world, that's where we have to be, not just online.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely.
And when you're in person, you can tell who's on an ego trip and who genuinely knows shit, right? Yeah. Like, an example is Dr. Bob Plimmer from Courtyard Books, Courtyard Alchemy, who is running the Isle of Wight conference I'm going to. Like, he gave a talk at Star Club. You talk like, oh, sorry, I've forgotten this bit of demotic. Like, he's forgotten more Egyptian than most people will learn in a lifetime. Okay? He translates hieroglyphs and demotics from first, like, sources to tell you, like, oh, yeah, this is the magic they were doing 5,000 years ago. I'm like, what the hell, Bob? How do you do that? David Rankin, like, pouring through manuscripts for months and months to formulate books like Clavis Inferni. This is the real deal. And you can meet people and you know they're the real deal. And if you can't identify someone who's the real deal when you meet them, then you've got no hope online. What's the point?
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, and hey, you know, you need to sharpen them skills. If you don't have the ability to do any of that, you need to meet enough people that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And work on your practice. Banish, banish, banish. Like take 3 LBRPs and a middle pillar twice a day and call me in the morning.
I'll see you next month.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is a huge privilege for me to be able to like host amazing speakers, bring events together. I'm so glad I'm able to be back out and doing that and just be a part of the conversations. Because when you're there, you're sitting around the bar or whatever, or in between talks, you can feel this wave of experience and information running through it. It's electric, and that's genuinely my favorite way to learn things.
It's really something. I need to get over to the UK. I've always needed more excuses to go to freaking the UK anyway. So be a good time.
Come and report on one of the events.
Oh, yeah, no, that's definitely what we're gonna do. Awesome. Well, I didn't get enough questions from the nuts this time, so I'll throw you least the one question that I did get because it's the one that I sent you earlier, and so you've had plenty of time to think about this. So, who do you think wins in a fight, Crowley or Anton LaVey?
That depends how much smack Crowley's had and how much coke LaVey's had. But on a given day, I would probably say Crowley, because Crowley climbed mountains. Crowley, wanted to learn all sorts of physical disciplines. And LaVey had a great time, but I think he'd crumple like a piece of foil.
Gave
him a really good right hook.
I think young Crowley takes him like any fucking day of the week, and older Crowley might even still take him. Yeah. I feel like Anton LaVey would be afraid to get hit.
Yeah, I think he would. He wouldn't want to mess up his beard, right?
You have any idea how much wax I have to put into this thing to get it this pointy?
Oh, I really do. Like, I have one myself, so.
Seth, if anyone's interested in all the various things that we just brought up, where can they find it?
Okay, so if you're interested in Star Club, especially if you're in the UK, especially if you want to come and do stuff in person, we do open rituals every fourth Saturday of the month. So that is www.star-club.org, star-club.org. And the Visible College is for facilitating events, not just like around the country, but we have an event space we hire out. We can do anything from day sessions to weekend retreats to full festivals and camps. And that's www.visible-college.org. So visible-college.org. In that, you can find the links for the Thelemic Symposium, which will be September 21st, 2024, Era Vulgaris in Oxford, UK. Be there or be in non-Euclidean shape.
Rad. And you got anything else you want to plug here?
I suppose stuff that I'm going to kind of be at. So the Isle of Wight Festival, you've probably missed your ticket by now, but it's going to be a good gig and look out for the reports coming from it. The Welsh Occult Conference, both in Welshpool and Cardiff in May and October, respectively. Those are going to be good. I believe I'm speaking at the October one, just waiting for confirmation. And come to the Occult Conference in Glastonbury next February. It's going to be a fantastic day, fantastic weekend. And I hope to see you out and about somewhere and you can tell me what you think of me to my face. How's that?
Yeah, tell him CMN sent you. Tell him, I heard you talking to that idiot on that stupid podcast, and this is what I think of you and people like you.
Nice.
Well, Seth, thank you. Thank you so much for talking to us today. This is really great. I had a great time.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really glad I reached out. It's been fun, if a little bit terrifying. But hey, that's what it's all about.
Both of us were nervous, so, you know, we must have done something right. And with that, this has been Chaos Magic News, the only podcast that's not going to give you a snappy joke this time because I'm tired. if you want to find more of our regular bi-monthly podcasts, we are on Spotify, Audible, pretty much all the streaming services you can imagine. We're also on YouTube if you want to go check that out. If you want a spicy meme from my co-host, you can find us on social media, basically everywhere. We're at Chaos Magic News. And we have a website where we have articles and the occasional other thing. It's chaosmagicnews.com. And with that, Seth, you want the last word?
Be excellent to each other and do your will. That's my only missive.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.